Okay, it's a very deep question here, in nice and colour, from Anna. Ah, dear Ajahn, are female nunses, that's nice, nunses, female nuns, are female nurses allowed to touch monks in case of emergency? Thank you. Only if they've got latex gloves on. No. Yes, they are in emergencies. No trouble at all. So are male nurses allowed to touch nuns in emergencies? Of course they are. So in emergencies, no problem whatsoever. Ajahn, what is attachment? Is it just instability, non-stillness? No, that's a nice deep question. Attachment always comes from a sense of self, a me. And when there is no sense of self anymore, then that's the only way to let go of attachment. Many years ago, I just noticed the way I used my hands. I kept on picking up something. So stop it, put it down, let it go. So I put it down. Before I knew it, picking up something else. Stop it, put it down, then you pick up something else. It's really hard to stop your hand picking up things. Because that's its job, that's what it does. A hand grasps things, it picks up things. And I figured out the only way to stop my hand picking up things is to cut it off. If I cut my hand off, then it will never grasp anything ever again. It's not the objects of the problem, it's the thing doing the grasping. Because this is what I noticed. When I first became a monk, you had to give up all sex. No girlfriends anymore. And then you really got into food. And I stopped food, you know, trying to eat sort of just a small amount and just nothing nice. And as soon as I let that go, then I started getting interested in reading magazines. Stop it. And then you go and do something else. Have you ever noticed as soon as you let go of one attachment, another attachment comes up? Because I thought, this is endless. So it wasn't really the object was the problem, it was the thing doing the attaching. Ajahn Brahm, the I, the me. That was the problem, just like my hand. As long as you've got a hand, you'll pick up things. As long as there's a sense of me, I, an owner, a doer, a possessor, then you'll always have attachment. So the only real way to overcome attachment to your family, to your possessions, to your body, to your mind, the only way to really let go full on once and for all is to actually cut off the hand. See that this thing inside which you really assume to be you is just an illusion. Once that's cut off, then there's nothing to do the attaching anymore. Then you let go. And this was a weird simile because I really thought that I'd found this out myself, the simile of the hand. I really sort of assumed that this was just one way of looking at these things. Until one day, I was looking in the Samyutta Nikaya, and I came across the Buddha's simile of the hand. Oh my goodness, the Buddha thought of it before me. But it's amazing, I hadn't heard that from the Buddha before, and got the same simile. And that was really goosebumps. Or had I heard it before? In this life, no. But who knows what happened before. So anyway, that was a simile. So what is attachment? Attachment is the result of having an identity. Because as soon as you think you are, then there's things to do, there's things to attain, like sowan and jhanas and psychic powers and happiness. You really think you own this mind of yours. So, how to detach is a very good simile to get it down to earth. And that was the simile of being the visitor. I'm sure you've heard a similar simile before because I used it very well in Nolamara. Usually, if I'm not teaching a retreat, I would have been at Nollamara last weekend. And as soon as you finish teaching at Nollamara city centre, on a Sunday evening you come back to the monastery, checking with all the monks what's gone wrong, what's okay, and then Monday morning you start working again. From Monday to Friday, I would work in Serpentine, in Bodhinyana Monastery. Weekends, I'd work in Nollamara. 7 days a week, never any break or rest. And when I come to Bodhinyana Monastery, all these visitors would come up and say, "Your monastery is so beautiful, so peaceful, so quiet. You're so, what are you talking about? It's not peaceful. This is my workplace. There's so much stuff to do. It's not beautiful. There's all the trees that just need pruning, all the paths need sweeping. It's falling apart, some of it. There's so much stuff to do." And then I realized there was something very wrong there. How come you guys can walk over to Bodhinyana and see it so peaceful and beautiful, so relaxing, whereas I go over there and it's just more work? The reason was, you were visiting. I was the owner. And so I decided to do a little experiment. On a Monday morning, I would pretend not to be the abbot anymore. I would pretend to be just like you, just a visitor. So people would come up and say, "Can I ask you some questions on meditation?" I said, "No. Go and ask one of the monks, one of the residents, how many visiting today?" One of the other monks would have a problem. "Can I see there's been an argument in the kitchen?" "I don't care, I'm only visiting today. Go and ask one of the residents." I would see something falling apart, the tap was leaking, the tree was falling over. "Not my problem, I'm only visiting." And so I pretended every Monday morning to be a visitor, not the abbot. And then I found something amazing. I could see Bodhinyana Monastery exactly as you see it. Beautiful, peaceful, wonderful. But when I owned it, I only just saw all the duties and responsibilities I had. Now that is the difference between letting go and attachment. If you own something, you will never find any beauty or peace. There's always some more to be done, some problems to be fixed. But if you just pretend to be a visitor, you don't own anything. You're only visiting your body. So if it falls apart, not my body, I'm only visiting for 60, 70 years, that's all. No problem. If you go on holiday and you go into a hotel room, you're not really concerned if it's dirty or if it's just the taps leaking. That's the housekeeping's job. But if it's your house, you've got something to do. If you are going to somebody's house for dinner, somebody else's house, do you wash up for them afterwards? No way. Every time you go out for dinner in a restaurant, how many of you wash up afterwards? That's only if you can't pay the bill, they make you wash up. But most times, you know, it's not your restaurant, you're only visiting. You just eat and leave because you're visiting. When you own something, it's a lot of work. When you visit, you can let go. Now you can understand the difference between attachment and letting go. You're meditating. Are you trying to train your own mind? It's not your mind, you're only visiting. So when I close my eyes and meditate, "Hi mind, I'm only visiting, okay, no responsibilities. If you go crazy, that's your problem, nothing to do with me." That's called letting go, non-attachment. Being a visitor, not an owner. People have asked me, "My children, come on, it's not your children. You don't own them. They come into your life, you give them a body, but their personality, their character, that's old karma coming from a long time ago. They got their own personalities, they got history when they come out of your womb. Just like that one lady, I've got great stories of people who come out of their mother's womb. This amazing story. I wish they'd have got this on camera, on a YouTube. It would have gone viral. Because they'd just given birth, been in the hospital a couple of days, birth, that's all. And the baby had just finished breastfeeding. And, she was just leaning back, the bed was lifted up a bit. Just finished breastfeeding, and the happy baby just crawled onto her tummy, crossed its legs in full lotus, put the right hand over the left hand, straight back, head down, closed its eyes and started meditating. And the poor mother freaked out. What the hell's going on? Was in perfect meditation posture. Just after having a nice lunch, whatever time it was, decided to meditate. Where did that come from? Because that was just a baby, a couple of days. So your kid comes with history. It's not yours. It's just visiting your family for I don't know how many years. So never think it's your kids. It's just visiting. You look after them and then you let them go. Because they're not yours. That's why it's great. It's great when some kids come to the monastery. They can, like Anna over there. It's wonderful she can play around because she's not my kid. I've got no responsibility. It's somebody's kid in the back over there. You have to take responsibility. Not me. I can just enjoy her company and play around and have fun. Because it's not mine. She's just a visitor. But if it's an owner, that's called attachment. Do you own your car? Of course you don't. It's going to crash eventually. So, if it gets stolen, how do you feel? There's a story I wrote in Good Bad Who Knows book. There was this fellow a long time ago came to visit here, and he was Patrick, that was his name, and he helped out in the first years of Bodhinyana Monastery. And he would come and stay in a monastery or a temple or any religious place, help out for a while and then go off to another one, like monastery hopping. That was his life. And the only possession he had, the only thing he really owned, was his Harley Davidson. He had this beautiful bike, obviously worth a lot of money. No house, no investment, no other property. That was just it, because he'd get on his bike when he got fed up with one monastery and just drive off. It was his freedom. It was his passport to not being tied down anywhere. And he had a wonderful time at Bodhinyana Monastery. Then he went away and went over east. And he told me that one day he was in Sydney, staying at some temple or monastery helping out. He's a really helpful man. But he wasn't tied down to any person or anything. It's a totally free bird. But he went into one of the shopping centres, parked his Harley, went to get a few things, and when he bent back to the car park, his Harley was missing. Some lowlife had stolen the only thing he owned in this world. The only thing which gave him the freedom to come and go wherever he wanted. Someone had stolen it. And he wrote to me, his first of all shock, that the only thing he had been taken away from him. But then, his remembrance of all the Dhamma he'd learned. And he think, these things are only temporary anyway. They're not me, they're not mine. And then he had this beautiful attitude. He said, whoever took that, I give it to you. You can take my bike, but you won't take my happiness and my freedom. So you can have it. And I hope you have as many joyful experiences in this bike as I've had over the years. Thank you. It's yours. And he was so impressed that everything which had been said, he actually took into his heart. And he actually practiced it. He let it go. The one thing which he really valued, the only possession he had, he let the thief take it. That was really impressive. But then what happened next? He suddenly recalled he was in the wrong level of the car park. And he went one level of down. There was his Harley. Has ever had that happen to you? I'm sure it has in these days. The car park levels look the same. So his Harley was there and he laughed and he said, this is karma. He actually gave it up. He let it go. It's a test for him. He passed the test, and when he went down, his Harley was still there. So he still had his Harley, but he realized he wasn't attached to it. He was tested. Now that is what attachment is. And when you can let it go, you have much more fun in life. These are these temporary things. They come into life and then they disappear. But that is what attachment is. All comes from a sense of owning stuff. And, you know, being an abbot, being in control. But I'm not in control of this place. You know, all the monks know that. It's just a myth, an illusion. So it's great. I can be irresponsible and just let things fall apart. Please explain in brief the Eight Noble Path. One has to be liberated. The Eightfold Path is just so easy. The first thing is having a right view, such as that you can't depend upon tradition, you can't depend upon the books, you can't depend upon what Ajahn Brahm says or anyone says. Those are just the signposts. You have to go and look at that for yourself, to be seen every wise person for themselves. And to get the proper view, because sometimes people believe and they just get so stuck in their beliefs, like I said with that experiment of the levitating the flower pot. They just can't see the truth because it doesn't fit in with their view. So in Buddhism you have to have such a commitment to truth that you're willing to sacrifice every view you've ever had. So it becomes like a right view, commitment to truth. And as I often say, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Sacrifice your knowledge for when you actually see what's really there. So that's one part of right view. And from the right view, especially the right view of, you know, trying to stop controlling things, stop owning things, a view of non-self, suffering and impermanence, then we get the second factor of right motivation, I call it these days. Not right thought, not right intention, but motivation. Where your acts come from. And of letting go, kindness and gentleness. The three right motivations. Not to get stuff. Not to be cruel or be aggressive in your meditation. Letting go, I sometimes call that making peace. Being kind, being gentle, the three right motivations of the Eightfold Path. Please keep that in mind, because sometimes people aren't gentle with themselves. You know, you feel tired and just push through it. That's not being gentle, that's not being kind. Or they try and get something. That's not letting go. That's amassing more stuff, you know, for your identity, for your sense of self. And then from that, from letting go, being kind, being gentle, the third factor of right speech, right action, number four, right life, that they obviously follow. You only break precepts and do wrong actions and wrong speech or wrong livelihood. You don't know how to let go. You want to amass things. You don't know what kindness is. You hurt people and animals. You don't know how to be gentle. So from those right motivations, where your acts come from, then comes the third, fourth and fifth factor. And then from that you learn how to restrain, to stop, which is right effort. Effort is a very hard word, because it's not effort, it's like right stopping, restraint, saying no, letting go. It's the effort of the donkey to stop chasing, to renounce, give up, abandon. And then from that you get the mindfulness. When you start letting go, being kind, being gentle, your mindfulness gets incredibly strong. Your precepts are good, you're not messing around, and because you're restraining, you're stopping, all the energy is going into mindfulness, and mindfulness starts to get really, really strong. It becomes the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. When the mindfulness gets very strong and happy and powerful, then it's so easy to get into stillness, into the jhanas, which is number eight. And once you get into the jhanas, number nine and number ten come along. Seeing things as they truly are. The right liberation and the knowledge that you're liberated. The eight things you do and the two things which happen afterwards. That is the Eightfold Path. In brief, of course you can go all night on this, Can we replace sleep with deep meditation? You can't do it, but if it happens naturally, fine. So don't think, okay, I'm going to meditate instead of sleeping, and think of it as something you're trying to achieve. But it does happen. You get some really nice meditation, you're carrying along meditating, you don't want to go to sleep, carry on. It's one of the reasons why we have no bells and schedule on this retreat. Because it does happen to people sometimes. The meditation gets so powerful, so strong, so happy, so joyful. It gets 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. You don't want to go to sleep. You're having a great time. Carry on. In some retreats, you've got to get up at 4 o'clock. If you don't get up, then go to your room. So people get afraid. Oh, I better go to bed now. Otherwise, then I'm going to get into trouble by missing out on the morning meeting. Imagine that was the Buddha. Haven't got enlightened yet, getting close, I better go to bed now under the Bodhi tree because I've got to get up at 4 o'clock. He wouldn't have got enlightened. So you keep it this beautiful, natural way of meditating. If you feel tired, go to bed. If you feel awake, carry on meditating. And it sometimes happens, you do meditate all night. You're not afraid because you know that you can just get up for breakfast and after breakfast go and have a sleep. Don't worry about the talk, it's all recorded, you can hear it later on. So this is the beautiful freedom of this routine. If you have energy and you want to stay up all night, go for it. But don't do it, plan it all out. Right, tonight's the night, I'm going to stay up all night. That's so much ego, spiritual pride. If it happens naturally, do it. Don't be afraid. Because it's true. When you really get lots of meditation, your sleep requirements get less and less and less and less. Human population keeps increasing. It's predicted about 50 million in 2050, more than 50 million, billion I think they meant. How does this relate with reincarnations and species extinction? Indeed, the number of human beings has increased so much in the last 20 years. And the number of other species like monkeys and elephants have actually decreased. So it doesn't really take to be a rocket scientist to realize that where have all those monkeys gone? They are your children. The elephants, they are the terrorists. It's obvious. So all these beings who used to be animals have now got reborn as human beings. Doesn't that answer a lot of questions about modern children? You call your kid a little monkey, you don't know how true that was. So that's where it's all come from. And don't ever think that human beings are so superior to the animals. Time and time and time again, you find animals doing amazing things. I always like to get people, if you haven't done this already, one of the things on the YouTube which really convinced me was the videos of Alex, A-L-E-X, the parrot. African grey parrot who can talk. Really good English. Such good English, he could probably get, pass his, ESL exam to get a permanent resident visa in Australia. No, honestly, he has a conversation with you. It's a parrot. And it's spooky. Because you see the video, and there's people talking to him, and the parrot answers back. And he's also a parrot with attitude. And the latest one I saw a video of him, he was just saying, oh, can I go now? I'm bored. Because this poor parrot has to talk with people every day. And he's a parrot, he wants to sort of do his own thing, not just talk English all the time, but because he can talk English and he can have a conversation with people, people keep coming again. It's just like sometimes me, you get asked the same question again and again and again. Sometimes I think, oh, can I go now? I can really relate to that parrot. So have a look at it. It's really brilliant. It's actually the parrot diary. He's got a few disciples. And I remember in one of the videos, I think, that they were teaching the disciples, and Alex was watching and said, you didn't say that right. And the parrot was correcting other parrots. So it's obvious, intelligent. It had speech and was using it intelligently, with emotions, with attitude, and that was really spooky. The real thing. Alex the parrot. Lots of videos of him on YouTube. Worth watching. And then it makes you think of animals in a totally different way. Is it true if different between Sotapanna and Arahat is full and constant mindful of Anatta? Pretty close there, yeah. Because the Sotapanna, they know Anatta, non-self. This is a stream winner. I'll go over this later on because there's lots of questions about this. Yeah, the stream winner knows non-self, but forgets from time to time. Just like Ananda was a stream winner, but sometimes when the Buddha passed away, he was just so overcome. He said the Dharma just disappeared. He couldn't see anything. Comes back again afterwards. But the best description of the difference is the simile of the shipwrecked sailors. One of the shipwrecked sailors, I won't go through all of them, one of the shipwrecked sailors are in the ocean, bobbing up and down, and they can see dry land in the distance. That's the stream winner. They can see his safety. They haven't achieved safety yet. And the next stage of one's return, they're swimming towards the shore. Didn't say if they're halfway, a quarter of the way, three quarters of the way, but they're on the way. They're swimming. And that's a once returner. The non-returner, they're so close to the shore, they can actually stand up. They're still in the waves, in the surf, but they can just wade the rest of the way. And that's the non-returner, the anagami. And the last one, the arahat, they're on the beach, sitting down under the coconut tree, having a lovely cup of tea with condensed milk. Or whatever else you like. They've made it. They're safe. So that's one of the similes of the Buddha. And that one is, paints a much better picture. Can you kindly explain the different contemplations that can be done to reduce, remove the five hindrances as explained in the suttas? Contemplating their danger could be useful, but what are the other skillful contemplations? Oh, there's just so many heaps of these. The contemplations that can be done to remove the five hindrances, like the first one, like desire, is actually to see the other part of the situation. If you, for example, really get into your food when you're here and find you're eating too much, you'd actually look at that food, and somewhere inside that food is your shit. Because it all goes into your mouth, and all the good stuff gets absorbed by your body, and what's left over comes out the other end. So that feces can't come from anywhere else. It's actually in the food you're eating. It's in the food you're eating. You take some of it out for your body, and the rest, what's left over, is your feces. So you look at that plate of beautiful rice and noodles or curry, and that is actually feces in there. But look at that. It's feces, but it's all covered up with, you know, the white of the rice, or the yellow of the curry, but it's feces in there. That soon means you don't get hungry anymore. It's a great way for losing weight. But if you don't eat enough, then you make it very, very delicious. So what you do these contemplations to balance, so you don't go to desire, you don't go to aversion. If you've got very aversive, very angry at someone in your hut, making too much noise, then that's a hindrance for you. So develop some compassion for them. Poor person, it's probably the first retreat they've ever been on. They're trying their very best. Some people, maybe they were. If they make a lot of noise, they snore a lot, maybe they were an elephant in their past life. And that's what elephants make great noise with their trumpets. So, you know, that's obviously, they just can't help it. That's just their past life coming up in this life. So you use something to balance the aversion and just to make it sort of... So it's not affecting you anymore. So those are the sorts of things. Something to balance. So you don't go to extremes. You keep in the middle. So you don't have desire, you don't have aversions. But also, one of the greatest of contemplations, which I always like, is anatta, non-self. So I say, you don't own anything. So who's trying to attain something here? So you become enlightened. So what becomes enlightened? Can you ask me that question? Because when I was in Sri Lanka last time, in front of a video, a senior monk asked me, Ajahn Brahm, come on, are you enlightened? And he said, I know that it's against the rules to tell a layperson, but I'm a monk. You can't excuse yourself. So I answered him. Venerable sir, if you can tell me what is enlightened, is it my body, the first khanda? Is it my perception, the second khanda, the vedana, the feeling? My second kanda, my sanya, is that what is enlightened? Is it my sankara is enlightened? Is my consciousnesses are enlightened? If it's my consciousnesses, which one is enlightened? The mind consciousness, that seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, because none of them really exist. They come and go. So which one is enlightened? And he smiled and never answered a question again. Who is trying to become enlightened? Which of your five kandas is trying to become enlightened? And it's obvious, there's nothing there. So, if you do become enlightened, you don't become enlightened. It's when you vanish. Then, enlightenment is there. The path is, one of the great quotes in the Visuddhimagga, but no traveller on it is seen. Jhana is, but no one achieves jhana. Not a person, you vanish. Enlightenment is, but no person enters it. You vanish first of all. And that was the other question which they asked me. Okay, Ajahn Brahm, jhanas. You write about them, you talk about them. Okay, Ajahn Brahm, be honest. Can you attain all those things you write about? Can you attain jhana, Ajahn Brahm? And people get very interested. At last, Ajahn Brahm has been opening up and being honest. And of course, I tell people, as a monk, as a bhikkhu, I have to be honest. I have to be truthful. I cannot lie to you. So I say, Ajahn Brahm cannot attain jhanas. And people, oh no! We trusted him all this time. I've come here especially to get a jhana. Ajahn Brahm can't get a jhana. I'm out of here. I want my money back. The fraud. But of course, he's always, you know, answering you to teach you some dhamma. So Ajahn Brahm cannot attain jhanas. Ajahn Brahm has to vanish first. When Ajahn Brahm disappears, then the jhanas appear. I have to get out. I have to butt out. I have to disappear and vanish. So if you want to attain a jhana, you can't. You have to vanish first of all. Ananda has to disappear. And then these things happen. Because as soon as Ananda is there, you always mess around. You can't be still. When there's a sense of self, it's always holding things, grasping. If there's a hand, you'll be picking up things. So when you disappear and let go, vanish, then the jhana's happened. You don't attain them though. That's the whole reason why to say you attain jhanas, the whole idea is totally ridiculous. So anyone here who's trying to attain jhanas, you're wasting your time. Anyone here who's trying to become a stream winner, you're wasting your time. Anyone here who's trying to be still and vanish, welcome. You're going to know what stream winning is and what jhanas are. You have to vanish. Go, baby, go. So anyway, those are different. That's the best, anatta contemplation. If the Buddha's teaching will not disappear in the next 2500 years, why do they talk about the next Buddha? We see the big picture in Buddhism. Not 2500 years, 2500 years, million years, was it 300... 30,000 million years. Because there is this great Buddhist cosmology where the Buddha said that the first level of devas is the realm of the four great kings. That's the name they give it. And in that heavenly realm, that one day is like 50 years. And those beings, they live for 200 years of their years. So straight away, because I did maths, it's so easy to find out in that realm it's equivalent to how many human years. And the next realm up from there is the Tawa Tingsa realm, and that they live for twice as long, and one of their days is worth 100 years of human life. Just one day, 100 years. So you can figure how long that realm lasted. It was multiplied by four, every realm you go up. Right to one of the highest heavenly realms, the realm of those who... Interesting, real power over other people's creations. And that's where Mara lives,
Probably that's the control freak in chief realm. And then, above that is Brahma, the being who sometimes thinks they're God. Now, interestingly, even in the, what's it called, the Gnostic Gospels, this is supposed to be the sayings of Jesus, found in Nag Hammadi, about the same time as the Dead Sea Scrolls, but suppressed. Even in there, there's a saying there that God is up in his heaven saying, I am the creator of all that is, the Father, the begetter, the all-powerful, the omnipotent, blah, 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 like God usually says. And this is in sayings of Jesus. And then this God hears someone say, no, you're not. There are other beings in this universe who have no knowledge of God. Who said that? I don't know who said that. What God didn't know, even in the Gnostic Gospels of Christianity. So this God believes he is the chief. That is his illusion. There's other beings way above that. But anyway, in that realm, they say that realm lasts a whole eon. And it makes a lot of sense that that realm is also four times as long as the realm of those who will power other people's creations, the control freak realm. And so I quickly did the calculation. And it came from, I forget now, probably about 36,000 million years for the age of the eon. And in physics, from the Big Bang to now, most people say it's about 13 to 14,000 million years. It's in the ballpark about the universe about 30 or 40% through. And as a scientist, that was amazing. That is acceptable. So, this is the time span. 25,000 years or 2,000, that's a pop, it's a finger snap, that's hardly anything at all. We're looking at 36,000 million years. And that's just one eon. In Buddhism, if you go into these jhana realms, they last 20, 100, 1,000 eons of existence. Big time spans in Buddhism. Big picture. So that's wonderful, that one. So, of course there'd be other Buddhas. There would be Buddhas before. And why before Buddha Gautama was Buddha Kassapa? It's because one of the great laws of Dharma, but this is not from Buddhism, but you all know this, is Murphy's Law. You know Murphy's Law? That's one of the greatest laws of science. If it can happen, it will happen. If it can happen as a Buddha, it will happen. That's why there's many Buddhas. It means teaching a Buddha disappears. Yeah, it disappears for a while, but then it comes back again. And then it disappears again, just like everything else in life. Comes and goes, rises and falls. This is our world. During breath meditation, when sensations across the body and the third eye. I've got four eyes, not third eye. One eye, two eyes, three eye, four eyes. That's why they've called people with glasses. When I was a kid, they called them four eyes. And that was derogatory. I thought it was really good. I've got two more eyes than you have. Or did you come to the conference? The conference we did in August, and there was a cyborg who really did have a third eye. He had this camera. And it was an electric camera, and it was put into his, fused into his skull, which turns the light into vibrations. And after about, was it 6 months or 9 months, he started to be able to see those vibrations because he was colorblind. And because he was colorblind, you know, really quite a lot colorblind, you know, it made life very difficult. So he had this eye in the front of him, and this fused into his skull, and he could actually learn how to see through vibrations. And his realm of sight was much bigger than human beings. He could see in the infrared, ultraviolet. He could see what other animals could see, which human beings can't. He really did have a third eye. He's an incredible person to talk to. It just shows you just how our senses are so limited. What happens if you give a person another sense, or actually expand the sense of sight? Brilliant guy. So anyway, what am I talking about? Third eye arise. Do we ignore it or follow it or just be aware of it. Or sensations across the body and the third eye arise. Usually look upon those things as distractions. So go to the center of the screen, the breath, and all those other stuff, just let them fade away, because you're trying to let go of the body. And what actually happens, an important part of meditation, is that if you keep awareness of the body when you get into quite deep states of meditation, the energy which should be staying in your mind starts to leak into your body. And, you know, powerful mind states, but you've still got you've still got some connection to your body. So it actually just goes into your body. You get kundalini experiences and other experiences, which are actually not really good stuff. They just disturb the body. Good energy, but in the wrong place. So it's advisable to separate your mind from the body as soon as you possibly can. So you watch the breath, the rest of the body disappears. You haven't got a clue where your breath is being observed. You don't know what your legs are doing, your arms are doing, all that sort of stuff vanishes, even your head vanishes. So you've just got your breath. And when that starts to vanish, the incredible energies which you experience stay in your mind and they don't leak into your body. So if you can let go of the body, the sooner the better in meditation. I'm going to the bottom of the pile now so that people who wrote these yesterday can actually have a chance. If one still has attachment to love and relationship, should he still consider ordination? What if he falls in love as a monastic? Oh, it's very easy. You just ask for a bottle of their shit. What do you do if when you fall in love in a robe and you can't let go like an arahat because the passion defilements is too strong and your practice is too weak, no jhana at all? Isn't it a bit pathetic to run away from intimacy? Is it what monastic life is about? Shallow, non-interactive life? Shallow? Relationships are shallow because you're not really sort of seeing what's going on inside of yourself. All your attention is out with the fantasy of the person you're attaching to. What is love anyway? A lot of times, first of all, the first part of love is just the chemical reaction between two people. There's a great article some years ago about the chemistry of love. And if you really fall in love with someone, actually you're not falling in love with them. You are falling in love with the way they make you feel. In their presence, you get a high. When you touch, another high. It's the way they make you feel, the pleasure, the high, the joy, the bliss of being in their company. That is what you fall in love with. You don't really fall in love with them. You fall in love with the way they make you feel. Later on, that love turns to something a little bit more noble. You just, you know, you really love them. You really want them to be happy. And sometimes people think that, yes, you know, my partner, I just really want her, I want him to be happy. And the acid test of that, to really see if your love is selfless or whether it's a taxed love, is you come on a 9-day retreat and your partner is left at home. And when you go back after your retreat, you find your partner's left you a message that they have gone off to Bali with your best friend for a sexy weekend. How would you feel? If you really loved your partner, if their happiness was the most important thing in the world to you, then you would think, wonderful! My partner is having such a wonderful time in Bali. She's having probably better sex with my best friend than with me. I'm so happy for her that she's enjoying herself and having a great, wonderful time. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Is that how you would feel? If your love is really selfless, then yeah, that's how you should feel. But it's not, is it? It's attachment. What is he doing? What is she doing? I'm not going to stand for this. You get very upset and angry. Which shows it's not really love, it's attachment. So sometimes, when you have those relationships, you don't get as wise as if you're in a monastic life where you really understand what goes on in your head. You really see what love is. Deeply.
And one of the biggest parts of love is an affirmation of your own ego. Someone loves me. Someone says I'm most wonderful person in the whole world. That builds up your sense of self. You are worth something at last. Someone loves me. I must be okay. That's why Shakespeare once said, it's better to have loved and lost than never have loved at all. But he got it totally wrong, upside down. He should have said, if he was wise, he didn't know Buddhism. If Shakespeare had come across Buddhism, he would have probably written, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have lost at all. That's Dhamma. Because when you lose, you realize the pain of attachments. If you're going to be intimate with anybody, be intimate with this thing you call yourself. Get to know that deeply. Find out what that is. What the heck is loving somebody else? A lot of time people are just so... they believe what they want to believe. That love is pure. Love is blind. Marriage, an institution for the blind. Okay. But anyway, look, you try these sorts of questions and the monks or nuns who know what's going on here. I've had relationships before. And I've also been peaceful before. But peace is way, way better. It's not because of fear of relationships that people become monks or nuns. It's because they know the limitations of relationships. And they know the boundaries of such love. And they know the much bigger love. And the pleasures. I was having a great relationship with a girl. And I don't mind saying this, I tell everyone about this. I had sex with her in Gloucester, left her when I went on my first meditation retreat. 3 or 4 days later, not that long, I had the most wonderful experience in meditation. Way, way better, more pleasurable, longer lasting, more fulfilling than great sex. It was only about 5 or 6, 7 days, a week at most, I can't remember. Between having sex and having deep meditation. How I did that, I don't know. But the contrast was immense. And after that, I wasn't so interested in my girlfriend anymore. He had something much better. The bliss better than sex. That is called marketing. You say, yeah, I'm into this. And if you get into these jhanas, you'll know that. Blow you away. Much better than relationships. Anyway, is it true that when a person's in jhana, his or her body couldn't be hurt, e.g. bleed, burn, or even killed? Seems that way. Because there's all these stories of monks. Actually, I don't know the nuns, but... there's only a couple of stories I know of people in jhana. The classic one is in the suttas about this monk. He was meditating in the forest and his villagers came by collecting firewood or herbs or mushrooms in the forest, and they saw this monk perfectly still. So still he wasn't even breathing. And they thought the venerable monk had died. And being devout Buddhists, they thought, it's not right to leave the venerable monk to be eaten by the forest animals. We should do a ceremony and cremate him here. So they got some wood, made a funeral pyre, and put the venerable monk on top. They chanted some gathas, whatever they had learned, not very good, but that was the best they could do. And they lit the fire. Once the fire was burning merrily, they had business to do, so they went off collecting their mushrooms or whatever else they were, the herbs. And they were so impressed the following morning. When that same monk came into their village for alms round, not even his robe was burnt. That is what happens in jhanas. Yes, you can't be burnt. And even your clothes cannot be burnt. So do not worry at all. If you get it into jhanas, and if people think you're dead, and they cremate you, they put you in the oven, and as soon as the person who's in charge of the crematorium opens the whatever it's called, the door afterwards, "Hi, it's me again," you tell them. There, they may die. It's not very good for them, but you're perfectly okay. The only point is, please make sure you tell your relations cremation, no burials. Because if you come out after jhana and you're in a box 6 foot under, then you're in a bit of trouble. But okay, that's from the suttas. And there's one of the monks I knew, and he told me the story. He was a very powerful monk. He's dead now, so I'll tell you the name. It's Sudama, his name was. He was an Indonesian monk. And he had some amazing stories. I never saw this myself, but this was from a person I trusted, a disciple. She was actually a princess in Thailand, a granddaughter of King Rama the 4th or 5th or 6th or something. And anyway, she was on a meditation class once a week in this monastery, Wat Bawan, in the middle of Bangkok. Now, just like people meditating, and she felt something weird happening. So she broke the rules, she opened her eyes and took a peek. And she freaked out. Because this monk was looking at another meditator, and light was coming out of his eyes, going into this person's body. The monk with laser eyes. Real psychic power, because he wasn't supposed to be looking. But there this monk had the light eyes and laser eyes. Real. Anyway, this monk, before he became a monk, he wanted to become a hermit. So he went into the jungles of Java. There's no jungles left now, or very few, but in those days, jungles all over the place. And he decided just to sit under a tree and meditate. And he told me, because, you know, I was another monk, he said this huge light came. And the way he said it, because his English wasn't that good, he married the light, totally united with it. And I'll explain later, that's jhanas. And he said he didn't know how long he was in there, but it was days. And when he came out, he noticed the jungle was different. And he checked with the villagers, there'd been a flood. He'd been under about a couple of meters of water for days. And he didn't know a thing. Perfectly okay. Could not drown. And that was a true story, which I heard from his own lips. In jhana, you do get pretty invulnerable. So, if you hear that North Korea is sending a ballistic missile with a nuclear warhead to Perth, and it's coming your way, get into jhanas quickly, and you'll survive. Otherwise, you may think that's a joke, but I was in the office. Just, you know, you see where the computers are? When Ajahn Sujata was here, and I was answering some emails, saying, come in here quickly. And there was some app on the computers where you could actually see aircraft and other flying objects and track their trajectory. North Korea had launched a missile, and it was coming. It actually did come right over Jhana Grove, right here. You could see it coming. It was actually going straight over. And that's why that someone sent him an email. Get on this website quickly. You're in trouble. There was a missile coming to Jhana Grove. It was really exciting. We could see it coming on the app, getting closer and closer and closer and closer. And they said that no one knew where it was going to fall. It went right, obviously it went right over. It never dropped here and went into the Southern Ocean somewhere. But it came right over here. It's a possibility. That's really exciting. No, I couldn't see it in the sky, it's just too high. You know, because it went way, way over here. That's nice. Who knows? Kim Jong-un might have launched another one right now. And it's coming your way. Meant for United States or Japan, but you know, they're not good technology. It may come over here. Anyway, if it does, get into jhana quickly, you'll be okay. But that's actually true. You are invulnerable. Is nimitta a mustard seed before entering jhana? Usually, yes. But I'll do nimittas later on. After entering a jhana, will there be a nimitta? That's a very good question. There will be one there, whether you notice or not. Notice it or not is another question. The way you go in is the way you come out. Dear Bhante, how can I escape drowsiness when I meditate? Many thanks. Don't try and escape it. Open the door of your heart to drowsiness. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then it disappears. If you fight it, try to escape from it, you go deeper into the mire. I have never had the experience of falling into quicksand, but people told me if you fall into quicksand, for goodness sake, don't struggle. Just relax until someone comes and they'll pull you out. Because the more the struggle, the deeper you go into it. And quicksand is a very wonderful simile for sloth and torpor. The more you struggle, the deeper you go in. So just relax and let go. And sooner or later you just float out. How does one overcome the fear of ghosts? Have you ever seen one? Ghosts. Every retreat I like telling a ghost story. And this is especially for little Anna in the corner over there. Anna, have you ever heard me tell about the coffin ghost? How many people know the story of the coffin ghost? So few of you. Here it comes again. This is one of the scariest of ghost stories. There was a guy... Do the lights. Yeah, can you do the lights in the back, please? Thank you. And close the door so no one can get out. Very good. Oh, yeah, that's good. There was a man who came to the Buddhist temple one evening to listen to a Dhamma talk. And after the Dhamma talk had finished, late at night, he had to go home. His house was not that far from the temple. So he walked home. There was two ways to walk. The long way round or the shortcut through the cemetery. And he was not that afraid of ghosts. So he took the shortcut through the graveyard. And at night time, when there is clouds obscuring the moon, when the wind is very strong, every rustle of a bush or a tree you think might be something supernatural. So he walked through the cemetery. He was brave. He wasn't going to be afraid. He got to halfway. Nothing had happened at all. But just after halfway, he thought he heard something following him. He thought it's just imagination, but nevertheless, he started walking a little bit faster. And as he was walking a little bit faster, whatever it was following him also came faster. He started to run. And the thing following him also was running. He could hear it go bump, 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 following him. He wasn't out of the cemetery yet, but pretty close, when he made a big mistake. He decided to look. And when he turned round to look, he wished he'd have never done that. Because what he saw following him was the spookiest, craziest thing anyone had ever seen. It was a coffin. A vertical coffin with still the cobwebs on it and the dirt and mud falling off it. A vertical coffin. Bump, 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 following him. He let out a scream and he ran as fast as he could. And doesn't matter how fast he ran, bump, 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 The coffin bumped after him. It was catching up. Fortunately, his house was not that far away. Bump, bump, bump. He jumped over the garden gate. He never opened the garden gate. He jumped right over it. Bump, bump, bump. He got to the front door of the house. He looked around. The coffin was at the garden gate. The coffin couldn't bump, couldn't jump. But my goodness, that coffin could bump. Bump! Against the garden gate. Bump! Even louder. And the garden gate started to give way. He reached into his pocket for the house keys. You know what happens when you're in... He dropped the keys. He went on the ground. Bump! As the coffin broke the garden gate. Bump, bump! He started coming down the garden path. He picked up the first key he could find. Hoped it was the right one. Put it in the... He was really lucky. It was the right key. He turned the lock, opened the door, jumped inside, and banged the door just as the coffin came to the front door. He could see it through the glass. His coffin right in front of his front door. But he was inside now. He was sweating, he was panting, but he was safe now inside his house. Bump! As the coffin started to break down the front door of his house. Bump! The glass shattered. Bump! The hinges started to give way. It was only a matter of time when the coffin would burst through the front door. He ran up the stairs. Bump! And the door caved in. He could see the coffin at the bottom of the stairs. And worse, the coffin could see him. Bump, bump, bump. The coffin started coming up the staircase. He went into the first room. He could see the bathroom. The only other room in the house which had a lock. And he locked the bathroom door. And he went against the back wall in the bathroom. Bump! As the coffin started to break down the bathroom door, he knew he was in trouble. If that strong, evil coffin could break down the front door of your house, the bathroom door is no problem at all. Bam! As the hinges started to give way. Bam! The coffin broke through. Now there was no other place to run. The coffin was just about 6 foot in front of him. He had his arms spread eagled against the wall. Bump! As it started coming towards him. He reached for the first thing on the bathroom shelf to defend himself, some bottle of medicine or whatever. And he threw it against the coffin as it bump! Came up to him. And the bottle broke and this brown liquid went all over the coffin. And the coffin never moved again. It stopped. You know why? Because that was cough medicine. It stops the coughing. Cough medicine stops the coughing. Thank you. That's a terrible joke. But kids love it. There's one kid in Singapore, every time I see him, can you tell the coffin joke again, Ajahn Brahm? Can you tell the coffin joke? And people enjoy it, but most of all I enjoy telling it. The coffin joke. Okay. Yeah, so there are such things as ghosts, real ghosts, and I've seen them, heard them, they're real. They're nice, they're kind. What is the mind source? The mind doesn't have a source, it has a cause. And it's something for the mind to see. When there's nothing for the mind to experience, then the mind stops. The simile the Buddha said is in the Aggawachagota Sutta, and it is adapted from that. A candle flame. The flame of the candle depends upon three causes. the wax, the wick, and the heat. When any one of those three causes disappears, either the wax is all used up, or the wick burns out, or the wind blows the heat away, then the flame disappears. It's extinguished. It's gone. So, the mind is like that flame, depending on various causes. But when those causes, or one of those causes, vanishes, so does the mind. And this was the Buddha's simile, or adapted, when someone asks, when the enlightened being passes away, where does the mind go? And the Buddha gave this simile. When a candle is extinguished, where does the flame go? If it's been a good flame, does it go to the heaven and hang out with all the other good flames, happy ever after? If it's been a bad flame, does it go to some hell realm and get punished? No, it doesn't make any sense. The flame just goes out, that's all. And that was the Buddha's simile. The mind just is extinguished. It goes out, finished. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't exist in some ground of all flame state with all the other original flames. It just goes out, that's all. And the word in the old Pali Sanskrit languages for a flame being extinguished is Nibbana. That's a word. Even kids would understand what Nibbana meant. Oh, Dad, the candle's Nibbana'd. I've got lighted again. That's what Nibbana was, a flame going out. That was the way the Buddha used the word for your mind. Da, da, da. There's a couple of stories relating to Prince Siddhartha that I struggled to reconcile with his teachings. First of all, Prince Siddhartha's loaning his wife and son. What about his responsibilities as a husband and father? That is in the Dasa Jatakas. What's it called? Prince Vaisantara. That is not Buddhism. That came a long time afterwards. The Buddha never wrote that or said that. But that's come as part of the traditions which people just believe because they're told that. But if you actually do the research, you find that comes much later. And as you say, that does not agree with what a Buddha should do, what anyone should do. It's supposed to say he was willing to renounce everything, even if his wife and son. I think his son got beaten by this person. That's not, you can't let your children have things like that happen to you. So indeed, it is not the teaching of the Buddha. It wasn't part of the first recitation. It wasn't part of Buddhism at all. It came afterwards. And indeed, the whole idea of the 10 paramitas, because those Dasa Jataka tales, all are supposed to have the Buddha perfecting one spiritual quality, the paramitas, one after the other. And you know where those paramitas came from? From Mahayana. They decided a bodhisattva has to develop paramis first of all. And Mahayana only had 6 of these paramitas. And when Theravada heard about that, they thought, we've got to keep up with the opposition. So they had 10. Again, it's just spiritual materialism again. And it had nothing to do with original Buddhism. Just monks just vying for supremacy. So, Vaisantara, ask any scholar, there's many ways you can prove that that was not original Buddhism. So it doesn't make any sense at all. If you want to know what the Bodhisattva was like before, look at the Gatikara Sutta, which I said. There was our Buddha, very, very, almost, I would say that was probably his last human life, with Kassapa. And he couldn't even know what the Buddha was. But he was a monk eventually. And there got his teachings. Anyway, I agree with you there. That doesn't make any sense at all. The story just prior to becoming enlightened when he put his bowl in the river. Okay, that's a good one. The story just prior to becoming enlightened when he put his bowl in the river, hoping that it would go upstream indicating success. This is not merely superstition. There's actually a great teaching there, because the idea was that was teaching him not just a little minor miracle, but teaching him how to become enlightened. To go against the stream of wanting. Not to follow a current of wanting, of craving and desire, but go in the opposite direction. The opposite direction is not getting rid of stuff. That's another form of wanting. It's no wanting at all. Letting go. That, as I mentioned to quite a few of you during your interviews, this is one of the hardest things you'll ever do. Doing nothing, letting go, being peaceful, giving up. Because you've never done that before. The whole stream of your life, or what someone called the real world, the whole stream of that is wanting. Striving, getting what you want, and therefore getting happy. This is a totally different ball game. So don't apply the rules of the world to meditation. Don't ever think if you try hard enough, you'll find peace. Don't think that I'm going to be wise. I'm going to learn how to get what I want. So wanting is a problem. So I often mention many people come to retreats to try and become wise. So their will can be more effective. They can get what they want when they want it. They don't have so much suffering in life. The problem is, the will is the big difficulty. Even wanting good things needs to be abandoned, let alone wanting bad things. And here, there'll come a time when you just sit here totally content. By contentment, I mean there's nothing in the world you want. You don't want to be anywhere else, not with anyone else. You don't want jhanas, you don't want anything, you're just happy where you are right now. Those are moments of incredible peace. And you should recognize they're peaceful because they're states when you don't want anything at all. You're totally happy where you are. And you haven't got billions of dollars or beautiful men, women serving you. You don't need stuff to be content. You decide, I'm going to be content right here, right now, with what you've got. Even if you're sick and dying, you can do this. I'm just going to be content. Then you have peace. You've gone against the stream of craving. And everything which wanting and craving promised you, but never delivered, is right there in front of you when you don't want anything. You've hung. You've arrived. That's actually how it works. What is your definition of enlightenment and why that definition? Okay. This usually comes later, but because it carries on from the last question, some of you have heard this before, it's the best definition of enlightenment I've ever had, and it's the story of the five children doing the wishing game. Many of you have heard this before, but it's brilliant. Five children playing a game called the wishing game. Those children have a wish, and who comes up with the best wish wins the game. And the first kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for this new Xbox with computer games. I don't know really what I'm talking about. I've never done a computer game, but the latest computer game, I really want that. Fine. So that was his wish. The second kid had more time to think. If you're in any competition, don't ever go first. Give yourself some time to feel what and see what the other people are doing. Like this other story of the three religious people. The Christian priest, the rabbi and the Buddhist monk. Who decided to have some interfaith dialogue. And then they started to have like lunch together to get a bit closer. And they realized that's not really understanding it and bonding together. So in order to bond, they started playing games together to bond. And then one of those games was playing some card games. And one thing led to another. They started playing poker for cash. They were gambling. In this particular country, gambling was illegal. And they got busted and had to go to court. And when they were in court, the Christian priest was the first one in front of the judge.
And a judge told him, said, you've been accused of gambling. The police said they found you gambling together. You're an honest man. I'm just going to ask you straight. Let's get this over and done with quickly. You're a man of the cloth. Were you gambling? And so quickly the judge didn't notice him. He quickly looked up and said, Jesus, forgive me. No. Because you can do that. Do whatever you like and ask forgiveness afterwards. So, okay. Then the rabbi was next. You're also a holy man, said the judge. Were you gambling? And what the rabbi did, he did the thing which I remember doing when I was a kid at school. You put your hands behind the back and cross your fingers. And somehow or other that means you're not really lying. So he crossed his fingers and said, no, I wasn't gambling. So, okay, go. And the Buddhist monk was last. Always be the last. And asked the Buddhist monk, were you gambling? You know, you keep five precepts. Put your hands on the table so I know you're not crossing your fingers. You don't believe in Jesus. They've got no one to forgive you. Were you gambling? And the Buddhist monk said, with whom, Your Honor? With whom? So always be last. You know, you need the other two to be able. The other two weren't gambling, so he was free. I can't gamble with myself. With whom? So he got off too. So anyway, the second kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $1 billion. That was the third kid. I would wish for a video game shop. A video game shop and get many video games whenever I want. Obviously much better. The third kid, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $1 billion US. Oh no, let's make it $100 billion US. Because with $100 billion US, I could buy my own video game shop. That's number one. But the trouble is, as every kid knows, if you play video games as a kid, your mother or your father gives you hell because you're not doing your homework. So he said, I know that's a problem. So after buying with my $100 billion US, after buying my own video game shop, then I'll buy my own school. If it's my school and I employ and pay the headmaster and all the staff, then there's no way in the world they're going to tell my parents I'm not doing my homework. Otherwise, I'll sack them. So owning my own school, I can give myself, you know, reasonably good grades. You know, I don't want to give the game away. Not top of the class, but, you know, the top 10% every year. And after I graduate from my own school, then I'll buy my own university and give myself a degree without doing any work whatsoever. Therefore, I can play video games as long as I like. My parents will not really get upset at me. And also, whenever I think of something else I need later on, with $100 billion US, there's no way in the world you can spend that amount of money unless you're the Prime Minister of a country like Australia. They can waste that so quickly. But a kid can't. So with $100 billion US, beat that wish. And the fourth kid, saying $200 billion US is not beating it. It's exactly the same. $100 billion US means more money than you can ever spend. So how can you beat the more money than you can ever spend wish? And the fourth kid, really smart, beat that. Said, if I had a wish, my wish would be for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have the video game shop. The second wish, I'd have $100 billion US. And for my third wish, I'd have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. So the third kid had infinite money. The fourth kid had infinite wishes granted. Beat that. And the fifth child, who would win the wishing game. If you haven't heard this story before, it's a brilliant ending. The fifth child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. And that beat the infinity of wishes. Contentment. Peace. That was the Buddha. Enlightenment. So content you don't need to wish anymore. The end of desire, the end of craving. And when you tell it in a story like that, it starts to bring out what people think is happiness in this world. Infinite money. That's why people get excited in the US lottery. How many billions of dollars that was? Was it $1.5 billion or something? People were complaining, "Ajahn Brahm, you're supposed to have psychic powers, but you've got no compassion. You should have told me the numbers. We'd have given some money for the nuns and monastery. Yeah, how much? Well, maybe $100. Come on, 50-50. No. So that's what most people aspire towards, getting so much money that you can retire. But have you ever noticed those people who do get wealthy, what do they do next? They go into politics. Because infinite money is not enough. They want infinite power. All your wishes granted. That's why many, you know, the Donald Trumps, the Prime Minister of Australia, you know, he's a multi-millionaire. Why on earth does he have to worry about being a politician? What's his name again? Turnbull, yeah. Well, why do you got all that money? Why didn't you just relax and enjoy yourself? Why on earth do you want to go into politics and have all these problems to do? Because of power. Infinity of wishes granted. And that's a lot of times what people want here. They want to become so wise, so whatever they really want, they never get frustrated anymore. They can find out how to find the perfect partner, the perfect job, the perfect meditation. Just more wanting, and all your wishes granted. But much better than that is be so content, you don't need any more wishes. That is the happiness of monks and nuns. There's no way we can get what we want. No money, no real power, so many rules to stop us getting what we want. But we can always have contentment. So happy you don't need any wishes. That is what enlightenment is. Peace at last. And that is a wonderful way to end this evening's Dhamma talk. There's more questions here, but please remember, if your question is not answered, it's not my fault. It's just you haven't got enough good karma. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So have a nice evening, and if you do hear anything going bump, bump, bump on your way to your cottage, get the cough medicine out. Very good.